I'd like to learn with you this afternoon, Perek Aleph, the first chapter of Genesis, chapter 1 of Genesis, of Bereishit, highlighting certain literary and philosophical themes that I think emerge from a careful study of the Perek, careful study of the chapter. There's a tremendous amount. It's one of the most richest chapters in the world, in all of Tanakh. But I'd like to just highlight certain themes that I think are emerge and that we should think about as we study this perek beyond just trying to understand each word in its individual atomistic context, but to try to have a sense of the entire structure of the Sefer. Yes, Rabbi Kelman.
No, I was going to introduce
you. It's okay. You don't have to introduce me. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman, and thank you for hosting and doing everything. So I'd like to first start with what you have in front of you is a schematic organization of the Perek, which generally, when you just read Chumash, you don't get a sense of that, because we read a printed Chumash, and it just goes pasuk by pasuk without the scheme. And sometimes it's important to present a Perek or a section or a narrative outside of our normal framework in order to get a sense of what's going on. So first of all, I'd like to begin with the very famous question that the Parshanim, the classical commentators, struggle with, and that's what's the relationship between the first three verses of the Torah? Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The truth is that that verse is very difficult to understand. Because Bereshit bara Elokim is a very strange verse. It doesn't say Barishona, which would imply in the very at the very beginning. This very strange construct struck the rabbis and the Mefarshim as very strange. And so there was all kinds of suggestions that emerged in the classical interpretations. In fact, the big question is, what's the relationship between that first verse and the rest of the verses in the Bible here? Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Are the heavens and the earth different than what's described in the rest of the chapter? What does it mean, shamayim ve'aretz? Is it different? Because God creates the firmament in the second day. He divides between the upper waters and the lower waters. So what exactly does Shamayim Va'aretz mean in verse 1? Good question, no? What does it mean conceptually? What's going on here? And so some interpretations, for example, the Ramban say, Shamayim Va'aretz here is a code word for the primordial creation, what he calls Chomer Hiyuli, the original raw materials of creation. First, God created a kind of blobby material, and then he fashioned the rest of the world in the rest of the days. That's one interpretation. So Shamayim Va'aretz means something different here than it means in the rest of the Bible. Others took it to mean something else. Shamayim Va'aretz here is a reference to something else. So there's all kinds of interpretations. But if we look carefully at a kind of superstructure of this perek, we'll notice that probably the simplest interpretation is to see this as a koteret, a heading, for the entire chapter. As Rav David Zvi Hoffman and Kasuto and many other of the moderns interpreted, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz is a heading for the entire chapter. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now I'm going to play out the story of the creation of the cosmos. Shamayim ve'aretz is simply a term for the cosmos, as it plays out in this chapter. And if you read the verse that way, then it turns out that there's a wonderful, what we call in Hebrew and in English, a wonderful kind of structure where we begin and end in a kind of sandwich, or in fancy schmancy language, a literary inclusion, an inclusio, where it starts and ends with the same theme. And it addresses another question. So if you look at the two boxes, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. If you think about those terms, I'm going to call them Aleph, Bet, and Gimel. So the term bara, we'll call that Aleph, or A, if you like English. We'll call the term Elohim, which is the name of God in this beautiful chapter, as opposed to chapter 2, where it's Hashem Elohim, the tetragrammaton. And it ends with Shamayim Va'aretz. If that indeed, A, B, C, look at the end of creation. Vayichulu Hashamayim Va'aretz. We start with C, right? A, B, C, bara Elohim Shamayim Va'aretz. We then have the details of the creation. At the end of the creation, when we sum up, we do what's called an inverted order. Vayichulu Hashamayim Va'aretz. C, Vayichal Elohim Vayom Hashvi'i. Vayivarech Elohim. And finally, Asher Bara. We come back to the Bara Elohim. So we have A, B, C. C, B, A. Patach B'mai D'Messayim. And we have a beautiful inclusion of this entire superstructure of the Perek. And this, of course, highlights the Jewish division of the Perek as opposed to the Christian division of the Perek. As you well know, notice that I didn't write Perek Aleph, Perek Bet. This section, if you opened up your Chumash, you would see that this is chapter 2, verse 1, verse 2, verse 3. What we say Friday night in Kiddush is actually the beginning of chapter 2 of Genesis. But it's not really chapter 2. It's really chapter, the end of chapter 1. You see literally. And that's what Jews do. When we read this on Parshat Bereishit, or when we read it on Simchat Torah, we don't end the Aliyah at the words, Vayar Elokim et kol asher asav inei tov ma'od, Vayi erev ayvoke yom shishi. We end the Aliyah at Asher bara Elohim lasot. That's the end of the first creation story. The second creation story starts in chapter 2, verse 4. How does the second creation story start? Eile toldot ha-shamayim va'aretz b'hi bar'am. Notice again, shamayim va'aretz, which is the key word. Exactly. Some people connect it to the past, but it's, I think the simplest reading is, this is a new story after we finish the story of primordial creation of chapter 1. So the literary structure here helps us drive home the idea that this is one unit. We begin and end at the same place. Very, very powerful. Furthermore, as we look at the chapter, we notice something very cool, which was already noted by the Midrash, but not such well-known Midrashim. We know the Midrashim through Rashi, so we don't always know the less well-known Midrash, but it was really, really developed by people like Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman and Kasuto and Leo Strauss and many others who've written on Genesis in the last 100 years. If we start to look at Genesis, we'll notice in gigantic terms, actually, the way to read Genesis 1 is not as simply 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but actually, we really have to read it as two columns, 1 through 3 and 4 through 6. And there's a literary parallelism between the first 3 days and the last 3 days. So, for example, if you look at day 1, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or Vayehi Or, Vayar Elohim et ha'or ki tov, vayavdel Elohim ben or ben ha'choshech. So the first day, what's created? Light. Which of course is very ambiguous. Because there's no sun, and there's no moon, and there's no stars. So what light is around there? So the rabbis, of course, claim it's this or ha'ganuz, this kind of hidden light, whatever that means. I don't know, I'm not a Kabbalist. And it's interesting, the physicist amongst us, interesting, when they talk about the Big Bang, they also say the Big Bang, first there was this ball of light, but there was no sun and there was no stars. So light is at the beginning, but it's amorphous, it's unformed, it's almost ambiguous and it's very unclear what it is. If you parallel to the fourth day, what's created on the fourth day? The sun and the moon and the stars. Meaning the light that on the first day is amorphous, ambiguous, unclear, is paralleled by the fourth day, which is the light that's clear, that's formed shape, that has an orbit, that moves. We move from inanimate light to animate light. Light that is involved in motion, that goes around, that has orbit, that takes a specific form, and that has a specific purpose. In the first day, Kadosh Baruch Hu says he divided between the Or Ubein HaChoshech. In the fourth day, the Or itself, the Me'orot, are the ones who come to divide between the begin, between time and space, etc. We go to the second day. The second day, God creates. Yehi rekia b'toch ha'mayim, v'yehi mavdil bein mayim l'mayim. So God creates the different waters, the upper water, the lower water, the upper heavens. There's not yet any earth. Those are the things that are created on the second day. Again, inanimate, very broad, no purpose yet, no discussion. We move to the fifth day. What happens in the fifth day? Yishritzu hamayim sheretz nefesh chaya. That which emerges from the water, the living creatures that emerge from the water now are created. And the living creatures that, so to speak, emerge from the sky, the birds, are also created on that day. So you have the upper waters and the lower waters on the first, on the second day, and then the fourth, the fifth day, are the upper waters and the lower waters bringing forth the livingness of them, the things that are going to live in the upper waters and the lower waters. And then we come to the third day. And it's a perfect parallelism as well. What do you have on the third day? On the third day, God separated between the water and the earth. V'teira'eh hayabasha. And let the land be seen. And of course, as we all know from our study of Genesis, on the third day, it says the word ki tov twice. It says it first at the end of the manifestation of the sea and the of the land. Vayikra Elohim layavasha eretz. Ulemikveh hamayim vayar Elokim ki tov. And then the second part, in the second section of the third day, Tachei ha'aretz deshe. Let the land start to bring forth grass and be covered with grass. The eitz oseh pri. And let the trees start to bring forth fruit. Vayar Elokim kito. So the third day has the land and the fruit. The land and the grass and the vegetation. And twice kitov. What do we have on the sixth day, if you look at the scheme? You have the same structure. You have Totsei Haaretz Chaya Lemina. Let the land, which was created on the third day, now start to bring forth that which lives on the land. What lives on the land? The animals. The animals are created on the sixth day. Let the animals be there. Vayar Elokim Kitov, the first Kitov. And if I skip the creation of the human being for a second, the last part of the sixth day is parallel to the last part of the third day. Just as God said, let there now be vegetation and fruit on the land, what happens in the second half of creation on the sixth day? Vayomer Elohim, ninei natati lachem et kol esev zorei azer shal pnei kol aretz. Now you can eat from the vegetation. So on day three, the vegetation is created. Now we're told about what the purpose of that vegetation is, to be eaten by the animals and the human being. And we're told about that kol ha'etz asher po pri'etz zera zorei lachem yelo ochla. You can now eat from the fruit. So there's a perfect parallelism between the first 3 days and the last 3 days. Now what's amazing is, and of course the ketov now, just like day three, there's two ketovs, because there's two parts to this. So too on the sixth day, there's two ketoves. Vinei tov ma'od. What's amazing is once you notice that, you notice that there's no parallelism to the creation of man on the sixth day, the human being, which is one of the literary ways, before we even get into the details of language, one of the ways the text highlights the uniqueness of the human being, even with being part of creation, is that there's no parallel in the third day. On the sixth day, there's something which is unique, special, different, anderish, for those who like Yiddish, totally different than everything else. And that's the creation of the human being, which we're going to go into a little bit later in the shiur. But notice how the superstructure drives home the uniqueness of what is not part of the superstructure, what is outside of the structure. Yes?
Do these superstructures
exist throughout the rest of the Many times. But chapter 1 of Genesis is especially symmetrical, clear, connected. Day 1 is connected to day 3. Day 2 is connected to day 4. This is a real beautiful, and it really fits in with the theology of chapter 1 as opposed to chapter 2, as Rabbi Soloveitchik and others have talked about. Chapter 1 is about this kind of very ordered world which God creates from A to Z, begins from the lowest, most inanimate, and then develops to the most sophisticated, animate, etc. And you also, I'm going to say more, but if you have other questions.
What is the message?
So part of the message is the kind of beauty. If you've ever appreciated math, the kind of chokhmat ha'elokim, the wisdom of God in setting up this perfect world that went in stages. If I could use the word without getting attacked, it's almost an evolutionary kind of structure where God starts from the most simple, least animate, least sophisticated, and in each area it develops to something animate, sophisticated, purposeful, etc. Motion, okay, and that's the development here in terms of Genesis 1.
How would say a modern person to understand the rakia that separates the waters above and the waters below?
I don't really know, except that I think that it was the perception of the person who understood the world as they saw it through their eyes. Hashem is speaking b'lashon b'nei Adam in the language of human beings that they perceived the world around them. They didn't have quantum mechanics. They didn't have physics the way we have it. So, but it's a general enough term that it works for people who understood it. I think Rav David Tzvi Hoffman says something like that explicitly in his commentary to Chumash. He has a very important comment after he discusses this whole issue. He says, Pshuto shel mikra means, he's the only person though I've seen in the traditional world say it explicitly before today, meaning he says, Pshuto shel mikra is to understand the text the way it was understood by the first generation that heard it, which is a very beautiful, sharp definition of what the plain sense of the biblical text is. And therefore it's going to use imagery, terminology, theological assumptions that could make sense to the ancient Near Eastern Jew who lived at the time that the Torah was given into that culture and that context.
So it's like the
exactly.
Is that what Rashi means when he says,
No.
What is Rashi mean?
That's a good question, but that's a different lecture. And there's not a lecture in Pshuto Shel Mikra. There's a lecture, but on this, I think that it's important. Yeah. So as I said, there are hints of this in certain midrashim that aren't as so famous. But the people who really, really developed this kind of learning were some of the 20th century writers on Tanakh, like Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, Kasuto, Buber, Meir Weiss, Leo Strauss, and others, when they read Genesis 1. And then people today, like Leon Cass, I'm sure you've heard of him, he wrote a very wonderful book on Genesis called The Beginning of Wisdom. He's a professor at University of Chicago. So he integrates this into his reading of Genesis as well. But it's very clear when you step back that this is what's going on. And it goes further than that. When you start to look at the structure of Genesis 1, you also notice
that there are certain verbs that are only used in the first half of Genesis 1 that kind of disappear in the second half of Genesis 1. For example, in Genesis 1, there's a lot of calling of names. I don't mean like, you know, sticks and... I mean, God, on day one, Vayikra Elohim Laor Yom, God called the day and night. On day two, Vayikra Elohim Larakia Shamayim. Day three, Vayikra Elohim Layabasha Eretz, Ulumikvei Hayamim Kara Yamim. There's a lot of calling. By the time we get to day four, day five, day six, there's no more calling. Another example, the verb vayavdel. Vayavdel Elohim ben Or ben Achoshech, day one. Day two, vayavdel ben Hamayim asher mitachad hashamayim. Day three, no vayavdel. Day four, the last time we have lahavdil. Vayomer Elohim yehi me'orot b'kir shamayim lahavdil ben hayom ben halayla. And then from then on, there's no more havdalah. There's no more calling, and there's no more separation as we go later and later into the Genesis creation. Which makes total sense. The act of calling and the act of dividing is an act of primordial creation. When I'm shaping something, I'm giving it form. By the second half of creation, we're much more in a sophisticated place. We're not dealing anymore with the groundwork of creation. We're dealing with how the world as we perceive it is much more operating. And therefore, we've moved beyond those verbs. And we're much more, if we want to use the terminology, we're focusing on yi'ud, the purpose of the primordial creation now. What's the purpose of light? What's the purpose? And the animals are there and they're blessed and they're given purpose and they're given light, etc., etc. And man is supposed to, lemem shelet, man is supposed to rule, pruvu, v'chiv shua, and dominate the earth and take advantage and yet protect the earth. All these things reflect the move from the first half of creation to the second half of creation. I want to now go... Yes, question. Okay. Now I want to go a step further. And as we look at this chapter, also, there are certain verbs that are highlighted. And the truth is, we have to ask what they reflect and what the purpose of certain verbs are that are only used a few times. I already showed you that the first part of the creation story, of the creation chapter, and the last part should be read as bookends. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz, ABC, and then CBA, with shamayim va'aretz and the term bara. The term bara is a very loaded term. It's a very unique term. It doesn't appear that much in the Bible. You can go in your concordance and you'll look it up. Go on Google, you can find it. Not that much. Not that much. Bara means literally creation. To create. Doesn't appear that much. And even in the creation story, it doesn't appear that much. What do I mean? On day one, God does not say, Vayomer Elokim yivra or, light should be created. He says, Yehi or, let there be light. On day two, he doesn't say that either. He says, Yehi rakia, let there be. On day four, Yehi me'orot. On day five, Yishritzu Hamayim, let the, right? The word bara is consciously absent from the actual days of creation. And it would have been perfect if it would have appeared at the beginning and at the end as unique terminology to describe the entirety of creation. It's very nice. Bara is very unique. Now, Ramban Nachmanides threw out a theory which is a very nice theory for medieval Jewish thought, but doesn't stand the test of philological analysis. Ramban said the word bara means yesh me'ayin, means something out of nothing, as opposed to other words like yatsar or Yehi, which means Yesh Meyesh, something out of something that already exists, which fits into his theory that Shemayim Va'aretz is primordial matter. But the truth is, if you open your concordance, you'll see that in the Bible, especially in Tehillim, the word bara and the word yatsar are often used interchangeably. So the theory doesn't really hold water, and it doesn't hold water in chapter 1 either. And the truth is, it seems that the simplest way to take it is that the word bara is kind of a very unique term. When we want to highlight God in chapter 1 doing something special, it uses the word bara. So it would have been nice at the beginning and at the end. But bara appears two more times. It appears in the creation of the human being. In fact, it would have been wonderful if it just appeared in the creation of the human being, because it would have highlighted, and it does highlight the uniqueness of the human being. There's no doubt about it. Take a look at the creation of the human being. The unit which I showed you structurally is different because it doesn't have a parallel on day 3. Vayomer Elokim on day 6. Na'ase Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu v'yirdu b'dgat hayam. Three times it uses the root bara, which highlights the uniqueness of the human being. It's the only thing in creation where three times the word bara. So it's perfect. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. The thing is that Hashem decided to throw a monkey wrench. And on day five, the Bible uses the root bara one more time. Vayivra Elokim et hataninim hagdolim. And God created, with the word bara, the big sea monsters. The taninim, today modern Hebrew, tanin means an alligator or a crocodile. But chavata taninim, you can go in Israel and visit. But the Bible uses that very strange term. So we have to try to think about, why does the Bible use that strange term? But to get to that, let me first discuss the creation of the human being, then say something else, and then finally get to that question, and we'll see how much time we have. So we started talking about the creation of the human being. There's no doubt that the use of the word bara is to highlight the uniqueness of it. But there are other literary techniques that the Bible uses here to highlight the uniqueness of the creation of the human being. Number one, as opposed to all the other parts of creation, there's no discussion prior to the actual creation. When it comes to the light or the sun, God just does it. Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, Vayehi Or. Vayomer Elokim Yishritzu Amayim, Vayishritzu Amayim. There's no diyun, what we call in Hebrew. There's no discussion. When it comes to man, Na'aseh Adam B'Tzalmenu Kidmutenu, whatever it means, I'm not getting into the question of who God is talking to. Is he talking to himself? Is he talking to the angels? Is he teaching us a lesson? Is it a royal we? But it's before the actual creation of a human being. Na'aseh Adam B'Tzalmenu, let's make man. It requires a committee discussion. This is something unique in the creation story. Not just structurally, there's no parallel in day 3. There's no parallel of preparing, number one. Number two, HaKadosh Baruch Hu here presents a yi'ud, a purpose for the human being, which is not mentioned by any of the other creations directly. The yirdu bidgat hayam bof hashamayim v'behema v'chol haaretz v'chol remes. Number three times the Bible uses the language of bara, while in the entire rest of creation it only appears three times. So there's a kind of parallel between man three times bara and the entirety of the rest of creation three times bara. That's cool. Number four, it uses poetry. Up until this point, most of the creation narrative has been prose. But here we get into the world of poetry. What do I mean by poetry? It uses rhyme scheme, it uses chiastic structure, and it uses the return to where it started. Look at it carefully. Vayivra Elokim et ha'adam b'tzalmo. A, bara, Adam, B, Salmo C. A, B, C. What's the rest of the verse? Bitzelem Elokim bara oto. So we have, we have Vayivra Elokim et Adam b'tzalmo. So we have Vayivra Elokim Salmo. Salmo or Tselem Elokim bara. We have the exact same words being reversed. A, B, C, C, B, A. Zachar unikeva bara otam. We have a very poetic, epic kind of language here, as Kasuto and others pointed out. And finally, in contrast to the animals who are also blessed, God talks to the human being in a way that he doesn't talk to the animals. When it comes to the animals, it says, Vayivarech otam Elokim, and God did bless them, saying. When it comes to the human being, it says, Vayivarech otam Elohim, vayomer lahem, and he said to them. Doesn't appear by the animals. There's a direct interaction between man and God. God directly communicating to the human being, reflecting the exalted, dignified nature of human being. So not only is it pruervu, but also dominion and mastery, majesty, whatever term you want to use, over the earth. So that highlights the uniqueness of the creation of the human being. Yes?
No, it's obvious, but it's an important distinction. A lot of people claim that we're evolved from the animal, or there's a connection between human and animals.
Which is no big deal. No big deal. I believe we're evolved from the animals also.
But the Torah is making a clear distinction that the...
Even if we're evolved, doesn't mean that we're not distinct.
No, but the Torah is
great. You don't have... I'm saying the fact that we're evolved from something doesn't mean I don't want to set up, I think it's a mistake when religious people set up this artificial dichotomy as if a religious person can't believe in the process of evolution. I believe that you can believe in evolution and believe in Genesis 1 without a problem. The Torah clearly is making a theological statement. It's not making a scientific statement. What does it mean that God did create the human being? Do you think, does it say anything about the details of it? Of course not. But of course, yes, the human being is religiously, spiritually, ethically, morally different than the animals. But we're at the same time connected to the animals. Animals also got a blessing, pru or vu. It's just they didn't have a relationship with God the way human beings have a relationship with God. Human beings, exactly, of course. What, do you think I deny that? Of course. The essence, but don't box yourself in to believe that to be a religious Jew, you either have to accept the theory of evolution or you don't have to. It's irrelevant. That's not what Genesis 1 is, not a science textbook. Genesis 1 is a theological statement about the nature of a world, and this is what I want to get to next. A world which is created by a divine being purposefully, symmetrically, beautifully organized without any hitches. Now, let's go back to the beginning of Genesis, and then I'd like to go further in my understanding of the terminology of bara and what God is trying to drive home, what the Bible is trying to drive home. First of all, I hope everybody, when they studied Bereshit, noticed how many words there were in the first verse of Genesis. Bereshit, bara Elokim, et hashamayim, ve'et ha'aretz. Seven. Interesting. Look at the second verse. Ve'ha'aretz hayta tov vavo, v'choshech al pnei tahom, v'ruach Elokim merachefet al pnei hamayim. 14 words. A multiple of seven. The second verse has a double multiple of seven. I don't think that's stam. I don't think that's just by chance. I think the Bible, the number seven is a key number in, because it's about creation. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day. Creation represents completion, wholeness. And so at the very outset of creation, we have the sevens, which are going to be played out in the rest of this book. It's not by chance that Noah's father lived 777 years. That's what it says, that Lemech lived 777 years, and that Noah the point of Noach is Ze yinachameinu mimasei adenu umehadama asher erira Hashem. That the purpose of Noah is to restore mankind to primordial history before man sinned. Noah is Adam 2, to restore the world to what it was like. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of sevens played out in the entire Genesis story. It's not Stam that, unfortunately, Lemech, Cain says that, you know, that Lemech says Cain was given seven generations and he will get 77 generations. The Lemech Shivim V'Shiva. But that's a distortion of creation. There's a lot of play on that. As we get into Genesis 1, in addition to the symmetry, the structure, the beauty, the purposefulness, the evolution, the hitpatchut, the movement from inanimate to animate, the movement from simply creation to then a purposeful creation where there's a specific goal in mind, lememshel et hayom, lememshel et halayla, pru urvu, uridu et hayam. We also have another thing that certainly since in the last 80 years have opened up to us from our study of the ancient Near East. And our study of the ancient Near East has given us a window into some of what's going on in Bereishit Aleph beyond the surface. One of the things we discovered is all kinds of lahavdil elef havdalot, the creation myths of the ancient world, right? Enuma Elish, and many other famous creation myths of the Sumerians, and the Akkadians, and the Egyptians, and the Babylonians, and the Assyrians. And we see clearly, as we look at those creation myths, and we start to look at the Bible of Genesis 1, we get another insight into that fact that the Torah is consciously trying to polemicize against the assumptions of the world that Am Yisrael was born into. And one of the ways the Torah does it is by using the terminology of the ancient Near East, but de-paganizing it and Israelitizing it, if you want to use such a term. What do I mean? I'll give you an example. In the ancient Near East, in the Canaanite world in which Am Yisrael came into, the word Yam did not mean sea. It meant the sea god. Tahom was the name of a god. Yam, Tiamat, and others. These are Hebrewized. What the Chumash is doing here is de-paganizing forces that the entire ancient Near East assumed were themselves God. Yam, Tahom, and other things, and basically saying to us, don't think for a second that these gods are gods. These are simply natural forces. This is the sea, and the sky, and the wind, and the sun. And don't attribute divinity to them, but just the opposite. They've been created by a God who is a God who's one God, not many gods, who has no gender. It's a very important thing. In the ancient Near East, the gods have gender. There's male gods and female gods. There's a consort that you, Baal and his consort. The gods engage in sexual behavior and have little gods, and etc., etc. And the gods create human beings for their needs. They have menial needs that they don't want to worry about. So they hire a maid and they create human beings. And they have passions and wars and fights. And what Genesis 1, as Professor Sarna and many others developed very beautifully in their writings, is it consciously attempts to de-paganize, de-sacralize these forces by using the specific language Biblical Hebrew adopts and rips it out of its mythological context, demythologizes it, and says, no, there's one God who has no gender. Gender is introduced in the world only with the creation of the human being. There is no such thing as sexuality before there's human beings. Number one. Number two, Zachar Nekeva Bara Utam. Kadosh Baruch Hu is the author of all this. He's the most powerful. There was nothing before him. There's no what's called in fancy schmancy English cosmogony. There's no origin of the gods. If you ever read Emunah Elish, there's a whole long origin of the god. There's power that existed before gods or the gods, Tiamat. And magic and sorcery are things why we can somehow outwit the gods and hook in to powers that can manipulate the gods. Which is the antithesis of biblical religion, which is one of the reasons you can't engage in magic and sorcery, because it's when you do that, you're basically saying Hashem is not the master of the world, but there's some sort of force I can hook into that's above God or can manipulate God, etc., etc. And so, an important element here, when one reads the story and talks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu being Mavdil Bein Ha'oru Bein HaChoshech, HaKadosh Baruch Hu being Mavdil Bein Hayam, and putting the yam here and not there, is the subtle and not so subtle polemic against the entire ancient Near Eastern world. And what's fascinating is that you hear echoes of this in later books of the Bible, especially in Tehillim and Eov, and also when you have these echoes of these grand battles that existed at the dawn of time between the various forces, and that God did smite the forces, and God put down the sea, that God haroka yam, and God, the sea that tried to rebel. And what's fascinating is if you look in the Midrashim have echoes of these epic battles also. Midrash is sometimes the repository of the mythical imagination and the destruction of that mythical element that kind of was totally destroyed in Genesis and yet continues to rear its head in Tehillim and Eov and other places. And so in the Midrashim and in the Gemara and Baba Basra, you have all these wonderful stories of the sea monsters that challenge God's dominion and say, we don't want to stop here. We want to control the entire vastness of the oceans, and we want to continue to spread. And God stops the sea here and says, till here you will go, and you will not go any further. Which is a mythical kind of expression, a midrashic expression, of the anti-polemic. The polemic here against the mythology that was at the root of the creation myths of the entire ancient Near East.
How are we to understand the trees not listening to God with Osefri and Enoch?
Right. And that medrash? Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a good... Unless it had something to do with that. There's Midrashim that talk about the trees didn't want to listen to God to bring forth their fruit. So this may be... Again, I don't have the specific parallel in ancient Near Eastern material, but there may be something to that as well. If that's true, then I think the simplest way to deal with the Vayivra Elokim et HaTaninim is exactly that point. The Taninim, as we know from the rest of Tanakh, becomes the symbol of Egypt and is the symbol of these great forces that they believed in very strongly, the sea gods. This was like a really, really important belief in the ancient Near Eastern world. And Livyasan, the same thing. Meaning, God smites the Livyasan, Rahav, all these things in Tehillim. God smites them is echoes of, don't think for a second that these guys were more powerful than the one true God. They are simply very strong animals and that people gave divinity to, but they weren't really divine. And here, the Chumash is making it very clear. Vayivra Elokim et HaTaninim. God uses the most intense word of creation to highlight even those things which you think, you want to call them dinosaurs, whatever you want to call them, the Taninim. Even those things which you think are divine creatures. You know, and it's interesting, you know, even today, in the South of America, not South America, but the South, or in certain countries, there's still, when you want to say something is really big, you say it's God awful. It's really big. Like in Hebrew, it would say Shalhevet Yah. Shalhevet Yah doesn't mean the fire of God. It means a really awesome fire. So God awful. These were so gigantic. People attributed divinity to them. Comes the Chumash, one second, and says, "Vayivra," relax, I'm going to tell you a question. "Vayivra Elokim et ataninim." Hashem Himself created these. Don't think in any way they are rivals to the divine glory. Yes. Correct. According to some. According to others, it means... Right. Harare El means huge mountains. Correct. Very right. It's not just here, but it's in other places in Tanakh as well. Right. Correct. I'm saying even in Tanakh. I said that. Shalhevet, Yah, and other things. Yeah.
What's your feeling about recommending Nochum Sarna's book on
Dreshah? I recommend it all the time. I think it's a book full of Yerushalayim, even if you don't agree with every jot and tittle. The book, there's a book called Understanding Genesis. It was written in the 60s by Professor Nochum Sarna, Zichrono Livracha, who died a few years ago. I actually had the great pleasure of meeting him when he was in Florida after he retired. And he donated his library to an institution I was involved with. And he was a Shomer Torah and Mitzvahs, but he certainly would probably not be defined as an Orthodox scholar. He lived his life as an Orthodox Jew. He davened in the Boca Raton Shul there, and he was honored and fine person, but he taught most of his life at JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary of the Conservative Movement. He certainly was part of the conservative movement scholarship, but he was a very traditional Jew, and Brandeis for many years. And so he wrote a very wonderful book called Understanding Genesis, which tries to integrate much of the study of ancient Near Eastern literature that was known up until that time into the reading of Genesis. And many of the insights, it's a very Jewish book in the sense that it tries to highlight, like Yechezkel Kaufman and Moshe Greenberg and all of those scholars, their agenda was to show the uniqueness of Israelite religion. On the one hand, you can't understand Israelite religion without understanding the ancient Near Eastern context. So when you read the Mishkan story, you have to know that there were tabernacles. That was a common theme in all of the ancient Near Eastern temples of the tabernacle. And there's a shulchan, and there's a menorah, and there's a mizbeach. But once you have that, then you have to look for the unique Israelite, schnit, spin on it, which is exactly what's going here. It's not just a unique, it's a total mahapach, a total revolutionary understanding that changed the face of the Near East. And so I, in general, find Nochum Sarna, meaning in the real scholarly world, they don't like him. They think he's an apologist. They consider him too conservative with a small c. He was too frum. He was not willing to say more radical things. And he also is not very into Bible criticism. That's not his thing. I mean, he mentions it here and there as a kind of obligatory nod to the regnant theory in the academic world. But what he really is interested in is the literary reading of Tanakh and the... Now, I actually think his commentary in the JPS commentary, which he wrote, is excellent. And I find it very... much of the stuff very useful, insightful, and helps Yerushalayim rather than undermines it in any way. Yes?
Yeah, but just in reference to what you said, that the tabernacle was a common thing in the Middle East, most of the Bible critics that I've read say that it's impossible to build a tabernacle.
Correct. They think it's a retrojection.
Right.
But that's now been proven incorrect.
Okay.
That was the early Bible critics. Wellhausen is 1830. Right, so that's 200 years ago. Right. The theory, but not the details. Many of the details of Wellhausen, Graf Wellhausen, have been thrown out. And today, it's much more recognized that there were tabernacles and there were things. There's other things that we have, that we still are up in the air about from Bible criticism. Well, some of the Bible critics, depends which ones, say that it was after the Josianic reform, etc., or some of it was written in the Babylonian exile. Yeah, there's all kinds of theories about the authorship of the Bible. Yes, question.
A little problem, as you're reading your statements, is that, Genesis 1 gets a rid of the idea of God, the statement of God, etc., etc. But it seems to imply, as if
I'm not addressing the question of authorship. I just use that terminology. I'm saying the Bible, I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu authored the Bible. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu here is presenting, you know, the Torah is making a conscious effort to make a statement. You know, it goes back to the old question that Rashi asks and the Ramban asks, of why does the Torah begin with the creation story? Right? Lama patcha Torah bebreishit. Should have started with HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. If it's a law book, so it should have started like the Rambam or the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Why start here? So what I'm trying to suggest, Allah, Sarna, Kasuto, etc., is because it's very important to start at the beginning and put on the table our faith beliefs about the nature of the world and the nature of God. It's not a question of a committee writing it. It's what the Torah wants the Jew, every Jew, to know, which was radical for its time. And radical, it continues to be radical in terms of its affirmation of one God who is committed, who is purposeful, who created a perfect world, which then unfortunately got messed up because human beings took, you know, things into their hands and, you know, screwed up a lot of things. But the world was... You know.
But the Rambam himself starts with the same kind of principle.
Correct. Exactly, the Rambam himself followed that. Also, Yisod HaYisodo, right. I didn't mean the Rambam, I meant the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, for example. So this is, I think, some of the insights that emerge from a literary theological reading of Bereishit Perek Aleph, the beautiful structure, the terminology, the use of poetry, the use of themes. The repetition, the name of God, I didn't mention, is mentioned 35 times, which is a multiple of 7 as well. There's so much richness in the Perek, the parallel between the first half and the second half, the development from the first half to the second half, the uniqueness of the creation of the human being, the structure, how it uses language, how it uses prose, how it uses poetry, the polemics of language and how it uses it to undermine the ancient Near Eastern assumptions. All this emerges from a careful study of Genesis 1, which there's still more and more to say. Yes, sir.
Just quickly, you're saying as well something interesting, of course, not just revelation, but it's also a response to what was going on around the Jewish.
Correct. Hashem, the rabbis tell us in many places, Dibra Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam. The Bible speaks in the language of human beings. Now, that phrase originally was used very narrowly by the Gemara. The Gemara says, why does it say mot tamut? Why doesn't it just say, when somebody commits a crime, he will die? Why mot tamut? So one opinion says, he'll die in this world and you'll die in the world to come. Meaning they try to find significance in every word. But Rabbi Ishmael says, Dibra Torah Kilashon Adam. That is the style of how you make meaning. Which is a way of saying in English, you shall surely die. It's done for emphasis. Now, in the medieval period, the term Dibra Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam was taken much further than that by the Rambam. The Rambam takes the phrase and says, what it means is that the Bible uses anthropomorphism. It talks about God as a person, that God gets angry, God has a hand, God has emotions. It doesn't really mean that. But Dibra Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam, the Bible speaks in a language that human beings can understand and relate to. Now, other Rishonim and other scholars, like Ibn Ezra and others, will say, it's not just Dibra Torah Kilashon B'nei Adam about philosophical issues, but that the Bible chooses to use examples and use language and words and literary forms like chiastic structure, like word plays, like rhyme, like prose and poetry, because this Torah, if it's going to make an impact on human beings, it has to speak in the language of human beings. And the first language is the language of those who heard it first. The Torah is eternal, but it at least has to have some meaning to those first generations that heard it. And so therefore the Torah, in this literary theory, is writing in a style, in a way, that has impact and meaning for the people who hear it. And that includes bidafka, making sense out of the world in which we live, by consciously using certain terms and taking it and saying, this is what it really is about. This is what it really means. The sea is not a god. The sea is a creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. You had a question? Okay, thank everybody for their hakshava.